growing up Jewish, I was always told that we valued education, that Jews were educated as a group, that despite our relatively small numbers, that we were barely surviving in the world, we had accomplished so much. We had won Nobel Prizes. We were professors at the top universities, and Jews were learned and wise. And that this was fundamental. This is a core Jewish value. And I've left a lot of that behind, largely because of the narrative of Jewish supremacy and the way that that becomes tied up in eugenics, among other things. But I think that there's another issue there, which is that it has this very stable, bordered notion of what counts as education and what it means to be learned, what it means to be a sage, wise Jewish person. And certainly there were things that were out of bounds for that framing of education. Palestine was out of bounds. Palestinians could not be an educated people the way that we Jews were. So to challenge Zionism, to learn and study against that ideology, meant to think about education itself differently. And that's at the core of today's episode, which is kind of at the core of this podcast in general. And I should say that today's guest, Eli Meyerhoff, really informed a lot of my own thinking about what education means and how to think differently about education means to think differently about things like Zionism, and vice versa. Eli Meyerhoff is a visiting scholar and program coordinator in the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute at Duke University. His research and organizing focus on abolitionist, decolonial approaches to education institutions and alternative modes of studying. He wrote a book, Beyond Education, Radical Studying for Another World, which was published by University of Minnesota Press in 2019, and co-wrote Abolitionist University Studies, An Invitation. He currently organizes with Duke academics and staff for Justice in Palestine. So, hey, Eli, welcome to Another Education Is Possible. How's it going?
Great. Thanks for having me.
So let's just get started all the way at the beginning here. We've talked to a number of people for this podcast, and I'm wondering if you have similar experiences to them. You know, a lot of the folks that we've talked to have talked about Jewishness when they were growing up as a place of complete belonging, as a site of identity building and inclusion and things that made them feel welcome. Is that how you would describe your upbringing?
Not at all. I actually think of myself as somewhat of an outsider Jew in a way. When I was growing up, my parents were different religions. It's kind of split between my mom's Christianity and my dad's Jewishness. I'm a patrilineal Jew, so from Israel's perspective, I might be considered a fake Jew, as the Zionists like to say. Growing up, I was pretty ignorant about Israel and Palestine, Zionism, anti-Zionism. I don't think I ever even heard those words much growing up. But my mom was quite a bit more religious than my dad. My mom taught Sunday school at a church, took me there weekly. My dad was a very secular Jew. He was pretty assimilated into the normal white settler capitalist American culture. I grew up in a small city called York, Pennsylvania. It's a very small Jewish community there, and I wasn't really part of it. My dad took me to temple only two or three times growing up. But then when I was 7 years old, my parents got divorced. That kind of shattered my sense of belonging and family. It destabilized any sort of attachments I had to Christian religion. My mom went off on a kind of new age self-exploration, and I associated her interest in new age spirituality and kind of alternative Christianity with that family break. So I developed a kind of antipathy to spirituality and religion. But after my parents divorced, my dad, for some reason, got more interested in me having some kind of Jewish upbringing. So he sent me to a Jewish summer camp in the Poconos, Pennsylvania, for a couple months across two summers. When I was there, I felt even more like an outcast among other Jewish kids because I was one of, not the only half Jew there. I felt like I didn't know anything about Judaism or Jewishness compared to all the other kids. And I mostly just spent time in the woods in nature club with the one counselor who was not Jewish. But I felt like an outcast in multiple ways, though. Also, I was kind of effeminate compared to the other kids who had a kind of macho, tough, masculine culture. I remember being bullied a bit. And I also at that time felt my first kind of queer attraction. So I was going through a bunch of kind of personal crises at once. So yeah, this kind of intertwined multiple senses of feeling out of place turned me further away from Judaism and religion.
So did Jewishness have a place in your life then, or was this kind of a rejection of, this is a space where I feel out of place, this is a place that's not for me, so I don't want any part of it? Or did Judaism still have a part of your identity and your upbringing?
It did. I had more of a kind of political and historical sense of my Jewishness, seeing it as part of a kind of emancipatory political tradition. I didn't have any close family in the Holocaust who died in the Holocaust, though I might have had some distant family, but none that we talked about growing up. Though we did definitely talk about the Holocaust. I learned about it at a young age. And all of my grandparents, the Christian ones and the Jewish ones, had served in World War II in some way. So I saw their military service as a kind of political Jewish identity or tradition in a way. I was proud of them for fighting against fascism, against the Nazis. And so I kind of romanticized, especially my granddad, my Jewish granddad, who was in the U.S. Army, went over in Normandy, I think D-Day, 12 days after D-Day, and fought and experienced a lot of violence that was traumatic for him. He never really talked about it. My Jewish grandmother served as a secretary in the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bomb. So there are definitely some ethical, political tensions there. But as a kid, I romanticized that family history. My granddad had brought back a couple Nazi medals, and I told myself this story that he had taken them off of the dead bodies of Nazis who had killed. I don't know if that's true. But I never really got to talk to my grandparents about this history, because my grandfather had a stroke when I was three. My grandmother had died before I was born. But I had this kind of melodramatic narrative about my grandparents, seeing them as victims, potential victims, as Jews who became heroes by killing the fascists. This is really kind of selective memory on my part, but it ended up being a source of my anti-racist and anti-fascist values. After my parents got divorced, I was in a kind of sense of searching, trying to figure out meaning of my life, since I had broken my attachments to familial and religious stories. As I was growing up, in my middle school and teenage years, I became friends with other kind of marginalized outcast kids. I sought a sense of belonging with my friends. But I got into kind of outcast subcultures later on, like punk and hip hop and skateboarding. Was introduced to leftist, anti-racist, anarchist politics through those kinds of music and subcultures. And going to punk shows, my friends and I would always talk about potential neo-Nazis at the shows, though I don't ever actually remember them being there. That was kind of an urban myth that neo-Nazis would show up and we would get in fights with them. Though I definitely did see swastikas carved in bathrooms around town, graffiti on walls, and we would like cross out those swastikas. So, I think a lot of my early sense of Jewishness was this kind of political, anti-fascist, anti-racist sense, being part of that kind of emancipatory tradition.
Yeah, I think there's such a beautiful education that's often happening in basement punk shows and in record shops. And during this time, was Israel mentioned at all? You said you kind of had you never heard the term Zionism or anti-Zionism, but having grandparents who fought in World War II, kind of growing up in a certain time period, for folks in the United States and for folks who are Jewish, Israel has often occupied a very prominent place. Did that come into discourse for you?
Not much. I wasn't really part of any active Jewish communities. I think I was one of two or three Jewish kids in my school. My other Jewish friend, similarly not really engaged in Jewish community and was more part of the punk subculture. I remember him wearing a Dead Kennedys Nazi punks fuck off shirt with the swastika crossed out. So that was kind of our Jewish culture at school. But I never identified as a Zionist or learned much about Israel. I think most of what I knew about Jewish history was related to World War II and the Holocaust, especially. I remember reading kind of books about the Holocaust that I think had Zionist undercurrents to them, like Schindler's List, for example.
Right, Lois Lowry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Books that kind of emphasize the Jewish experience of trauma and victimhood while leaving out all the other victims of the Nazis. I'd say I still had a kind of desire to be part of Jewish community more. I remember having a kind of crush on a Jewish girl, first girl that I liked, I think, in elementary school. I went to this Montessori school from, I guess, kindergarten through fourth grade. And I really loved that school. It was a very self-directed, child-led learning experience. So I think in some weird way, I might have associated my crush on that Jewish girl with my good experiences of Montessori in some way. But then I went to a normal public school after Montessori. I shifted in fifth grade. I really hated the experience of being graded and taking exams and having kind of top-down teacher-directed learning. And so I think, yeah, contrasting that Montessori experience with normal public school gave me a strong anger at the normal education system and made me desire to get out as soon as possible. And so I left high school a year early as a way to escape. I went to the University of Southern California on a full scholarship, partly also as a way to get away from my family life and boring suburbia.
It's about as far away from York as you can get.
Yeah,
staying in the United
States. Country.
Yeah.
Los Angeles, big city. And there was a slightly Jewish element to that escape route where I wrote my essay, my personal essay to apply for college about a visit that I had to the National Holocaust Museum in DC. But instead of writing about some kind of Jewish personal narrative there, I wrote more about how I saw houseless people, African-American houseless people sleeping on the sidewalk outside of the museum and feeling angry about how this kind of contradiction between this big fancy museum memorializing past violence while these people were left without housing on the streets outside. But I didn't really make that kind of anti-racist politics part of my my studies at college, though, right away, at least. I majored in chemical engineering, partly because it was the major that seemed to pay the most starting salary straight out of college. I really just wanted to become as independent from my parents as I could. But pretty soon in college, I realized that engineering didn't seem like a fulfilling life, too disconnected from political reality. And I felt like I'd become a kind of cog in the machine of the world. So I became friends with people who were in the kind of outcast subcultures that I'd been part of earlier, like the punk and hip hop world. And a lot of them were humanities and film majors. So I think hanging out with them helped push me further away from engineering. I also had an experience of going to the Democratic National Convention in the year 2000 in downtown LA. I went there because Rage Against the Machine was playing a show at this kind of shadow protest. And the police came and shot at the crowd with rubber bullets and tear gas. So seeing one of my friends get shot, had a really big welt on his back from a rubber bullet and inhaled the tear gas. And that was a pretty radicalizing experience for me. And after then, I actively started taking more politically oriented classes, started taking philosophy classes, added a philosophy major, got into the Frankfurt School, critical theory. And this was, I think, the beginning of my reconnecting, deepening a sense of relation with an emancipatory Jewish tradition.
Yeah.
So Frankfurt School is a kind of alternative, radical leftist, anti-authoritarian, anti-state Marxist tradition. They see critical theory as a way to study how all ideas emerge from particular material historical contexts and to really think critically about how we apply those ideas in our current context. So I got really into that.
And these are largely Jewish folks working in 1920s, 1930s Germany. Did that come into your kind of vision at some point, saying, oh, it's not a coincidence that these are largely Jewish folks?
Yeah. I think their Jewishness was interesting to me. Like, they talked about the Holocaust. They asked questions about why did the Holocaust happen? It's not just because people hated Jews, but there are more systemic reasons. Capitalism, colonialism.
So that's it's interesting to me because you're kind of blending this deeply grounded, almost rational analysis of their explanations with some of your more, I guess I'd say, coming back to the word, like romantic stories. Like, I know for me, what initially drew me to Walter Benjamin's work was not so much his writing, it was his story. And thinking about his last days and trying to escape the Nazis built this kind of feeling of romance rather than anything directly related to what he was working on. I don't know if that, is that the case for you, or was it more just you liked the Frankfurt School writers? And
no, that story of Benjamin escaping the Nazis and committing suicide, well, it's contested. I think that's the story.
That's the one I always heard. Yeah.
Yeah. That was powerful for me also. I think also learning about how the Frankfurt School members like Marcuse, Adorno, Horkheimer came to Los Angeles. That kind of resonated for me also as someone who had escaped to Los Angeles. I think also learning about how Angela Davis was one of Herbert Marcuse's students. I think learning about her prison abolition work and thinking about how her work had some kind of relation to that radical emancipatory Jewish Marxist tradition that resonated with me also.
She has a beautiful piece in Hammer and Hope just a few months ago about her long history of Palestinian solidarity, but it talks about her time in Germany, talks about her time at Brandeis. Brandeis. Anyway, we could go down this rabbit hole, but I'm wondering a little bit more about your time in Los Angeles. This seems like a time that's really your political ideals are just exploding.
I remember going to a talk that was kind of a dialogue between Edward Said and Arundhati Roy at UCLA in 2001. I don't really remember the content of that talk, but I remember that it inspired me to learn more about the Palestinian cause. But I wouldn't say that I got involved in the Palestinian cause then, really, but I think it at least got me thinking about it and questioning Israel. But I think my politicization came more in grad school. So in LA, I worked for a year after college as a chemical engineer, partly because I had stayed a fifth year in college so I could get a philosophy major in addition to a chemical engineering major. And I took on student debt to do that. And so I wanted to work as an engineer to make money to pay off my student loans. But during that time, I was working at a sewage treatment plant in LA. And I knew I didn't want to stay there, but during that time, I was kind of escaping engineering into grad school, applying to philosophy grad school. I went to the University of Minnesota for grad school. I moved there with my partner, Jekka. She had grown up in Minnesota, which is part of why we moved there. Yeah, but in grad school then, I really got a lot more involved in political organizing. But first, I had a kind of life crisis that made me kind of reorient myself to the world in a lot of ways. In my first year in grad school, I had a kind of crisis about what I wanted to do in academia, but also in my relationship with my partner. These were kind of mixed up with each other. So I knew I didn't want to stay in philosophy because it seemed too abstract from political engagement in the world. So I decided to switch to political science, especially political theory, where I could do or engage with Frankfurt School critical theory. So I kind of had this another kind of escapist moment where after my first year in grad school, I became romantically involved with someone who was Jewish, a philosopher like myself, philosophy grad student. She was also into the Frankfurt School like myself. And I left my partner, Jekka. Looking back, this is kind of a shameful episode of my life, but it's important for thinking about my life story here, I think. So I had this kind of brief but intense relationship, kind of long distance. And through that relationship, I had this kind of precarious sense of belonging in a Jewish family for the first time, really, in a way. And also a sense of belonging to a sort of emancipatory Jewish tradition, since we were both into the Frankfurt School. And I'd say this was the first time I'd really kind of passively adopted some Zionist ideas. I remember we kind of fantasized about living on a kibbutz in Israel, sort of a kind of implicit socialist Zionism, even though I still didn't really know what Zionism was, and I don't even think I knew what that word meant.
So what happened from here? I mean, I think we're kind of building this is really just a life story of how you came to be the person that you're still becoming. But you know, you're in grad school, you're for the first time learning maybe a socialist version of Zionism, but you're learning Zionism while your radical politics are still evolving. Your relationships are evolving. What happens next?
Yeah, so that long distance romantic relationship ended after about 8 months or so. And along with it, I think my fantasy of living on a kibbutz ended as well. I got back together with my former partner, Jekka, a few months after that. And now, 19 years later, we're still married. I mean, we're still together. We got married, two kids. Yeah, and I stayed in grad school at Minnesota, but I switched to political science, political theory. I got really involved in organizing on campus, especially around the kind of precarious conditions of life and work in grad school. Some of my advisors, my dissertation advisors, left, went to other schools, and that kind of put me in a sense of trying to figure things out on my own. And myself and a lot of my friends were worrying about what to do with our lives, since the academic job market seemed really tough, and we were paid very little as grad students. And I think a lot of my friends and I were struggling with mental health issues, partly because of these precarious life and work conditions. And one of my friends actually committed suicide in grad school. He had some serious mental health conditions also. And that was a really kind of a breaking point, a snapping point for me. I felt a lot of anger towards the university for allowing that to happen and for not taking responsibility for what happened. So afterwards, I got involved in organizing with other people who were trying to change the university and who were also angry at the university. There was a big labor strike. The staff union, the AFSCME union in Minnesota, over 3,000 members, went on strike in 2007. I was part of a group of students and one faculty member who went on a hunger strike in solidarity with the staff union strike. And I wasn't actually on the hunger strike myself. I was on the kind of support team for the hunger strikers. Seeing them put their bodies on the line for a cause they cared about was a really radicalizing experience for me. After that, through the relationships that we built in that strike, we continued organizing some other projects that continued our struggles, including a graduate student unionization effort, which was initially with the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW. Wow. But I was also involved in creating a kind of free university called the Experimental College of the Twin Cities. Through that, put on a lot of, or was part of a lot of reading groups on anarchism, feminism, Marxism. I was part of a bunch of other radical projects related to that, like an anarchist social center called the Minnehaha Free Space, which was bound up with some Native American anti-colonial struggles. I think one of my initial connections with Palestine solidarity organizing was through the Experimental College. There's a group called Teachers Against Occupation in Minnesota that was organizing for Palestine. And I supported them a bit. And yeah, I think they had brought in the group Courage to Resist, some former IDF soldiers who had left the military or refused to serve. Hearing them talk about their resistance was kind of inspiring for me. Another group, Anarchists Against the Wall, initially heard them give a talk in London at the Anarchist Book Fair. And then later on, I helped put on an event with them through the Minnehaha Free Space, and hearing them talk about their work as Israeli Jewish anarchists who would accompany Palestinian people on protests, using their Jewish identities as kind of a shield to help defend Palestinian people from repression. Mm-hmm. Hearing that was inspiring also.
So is this where, because I know through Twitter and elsewhere that you're very outwardly and explicitly anti-Zionist. Is this these moments with Teachers Against the Occupation, Courage to Resist, is this where a directly anti-Zionist identity starts to emerge? Or is this, because all of these are obviously moments that are, you can't talk about anti-colonial events that you just mentioned without thinking of what it means to be anti-colonial in multiple spaces. But is this time where your anti-Zionism comes about?
Yeah, it starts to emerge then. I think there was a kind of symbiotic relation between my organizing and things I was reading through my dissertation work and in reading groups. I definitely learned a lot from those organizations, Anarchists Against the Wall, Teachers Against Occupation. I also remember reading a piece by Judith Butler, this essay that they wrote on academic freedom, looking at how Israel destroys the conditions for Palestinian people's academic freedom through all the checkpoints and other forms of apartheid that prevent Palestinian people from having even the freedom of mobility that would be a necessary condition to get to school or university. And yeah, I think I was also occasionally still corresponded with my ex-girlfriend who had moved to Palestine and was engaged in some solidarity organizing. And yeah, but I think at this time I was learning more about decolonization more generally, rather than focus specifically on Palestine.
You're sharing your life story is turning into a exam, which you've already expressed your love of grades and hierarchical learning. But I'm wondering where education comes into the mix there. You know, you mentioned decolonization and abolition. I think you prefer, we'll get into this in a bit, but I think you prefer the term study, but broadly speaking, notions of education, how do they relate to those ideas? And how do they relate to your work as well?
I guess education is a term that comes from from Europe, and we use that term to describe a certain set of practices normally, and those practices, grades, and levels of schooling that we imagine as kind of vertically arranged, like the idea of ascending from kindergarten up through first through 12th grade up the higher education. That's a certain kind of imaginary of how somebody becomes educated. That kind of form of learning and studying has a very particular history behind it. Colonial European and people involved in indigenous communities in the Americas and in Africa and other places around the world have had different histories of ways of studying that have been bound up with different ways of living their lives, making the world. And so I wanted to develop better ways of talking about those differences and thinking about the different political projects associated with them and how different kinds of studying or education are related with those different sorts of ways of making the world. So that kind of question became a big focus of my my research and writing. Fern Thompson and I wrote an article together based on our different but overlapping experiences organizing kind of free universities. I was involved in that experimental college of the Twin Cities. She was involved in something called the Brisbane Free University in Brisbane, Australia. Both of those projects, there had been courses and events around Indigenous peoples' movements, their decolonization movements, and their Indigenous resurgence movements. We wrote that article as a way to think more reflectively about those those movements and how different kinds of studying were bound up in them.
And let's bring Judaism back in the mix. Are you feeling post-grad school and as your praxis is continuing in Durham, is there a sense of Jewish identity that's returning or continuing?
I became a little bit involved in Jewish Voice for Peace in Durham. I was mostly involved still in anti-jail prisoner solidarity organizing, though it overlapped with JVP's organizing. JVP here had a campaign called Demilitarize from Durham to Palestine. Well, it was JVP in coalition with some other Black radical-led groups. That had a abolitionist angle to it also, because the focus was to push the city to cut its ties with Israel, particularly to cut the police training program that they had with the IDF. But I wasn't too involved in that campaign myself, though. But I think learning about it got me a little more interested, engaged in Palestine solidarity. But still, I'd say I didn't really dive into Palestine solidarity until just this past year after October 7th.
Sorry, I'm wondering, what that looked like, but I'm wondering in particular that so much of what you've shared already is just part of something large and interconnected. And for yourself, that's not just here are the things I'm doing, here are the political causes in which I'm involved. It's deeply tied to your personal life. So I'm wondering kind of how you came to this work post October 7th.
It is very much kind of blending of personal and political here for me. Yeah, after October 7th, my partner Jekka co-wrote a statement of solidarity with Palestinian people in Gaza. She wrote the statement along with other professors at Duke and the Asian American Studies program. Then they tried to get lots more people at Duke to sign on. And that statement was the foundation for what became a new Palestine solidarity group, where a lot of the people who signed that letter became part of this group, including myself, a new group called Academics and Staff for Justice in Palestine. That's been one of my main organizing focuses over the past year. We had a few events, a vigil for remembering all the academics and students who've been killed by Israel, Gaza, themed around Scholasticide, also organizing to support a solidarity, Gaza solidarity encampment. During this time, I was engaging on Twitter more as an anti-Zionist Jewish person, kind of diving into my how I understood my own Jewishness in a way. I think what really motivated me was feeling really angry about how all these policies were being proposed and passed that were equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And I think this really triggered me in a way, since I had understood my own Jewish identity as a kind of resistance to anti-Semitism, it's kind of anti-fascist, anti-racist tradition. So saying that my being an anti-Zionist made me go against that tradition seemed absurd to me. So I was kind of tweeting through this sort of self-inquiry process, trying to understand my own Jewishness, and at the same time, trying not to center myself as a Jewish person and instead try to reflect or deflect attention away from my Jewishness toward the struggles of Palestinian people as the most important resistors of Israeli oppression, recenter their struggles. But as I was engaging on Twitter, I was intrigued and pissed off to get all these reactions from Zionists who were calling me a self-hating Jew or a fake Jew. So I decided to look at that rhetoric, try to understand where it came from and what it was doing. So I wrote a bit about that, wrote some tweets about that, and then I started thinking about how this idea of self-hate, self-hating Jew, seemed to have an implied opposite of the self-loving Jew. So that got me thinking, wondering how the Zionists were conceiving of love. So I wrote a tweet thread about that, trying to take apart this rhetoric of self-hating and self-loving Jews. And that I was drawing on this theory of love from Michael Hart and Antonio Negri's book Commonwealth, where they talk about love in different ways. They distinguish what they call corrupt forms of love from revolutionary forms of love. And I saw these corrupt forms really instantiated through the Zionists' ideas of love, in contrast with self-hate. So one form of corrupt love is identification, seeing love as a process of identifying with the state of Israel, seeing one's personal identity as bound up with that Jewish supremacist ethno-nationalist state. And another form of corrupt love is as a kind of unification or a process of unifying with another Jewish person through a couple on the way towards marriage and towards having a Jewish family, the purpose of producing Jewish babies to expand the Jewish nation. It's kind of reproductive futurism. At the end of this analysis, I then contrasted that those corrupt forms of love with what Hart and Negri call revolutionary love as a kind of mutual transformation, where different people are transformed, becoming like the other. And I talked about how anti-Zionist Jewish people can practice this kind of revolutionary love through organizing in solidarity with other marginalized people, especially Palestinian people in this time. I see this in practices of what some folks like Shane Burley and Ben Lorber have called safety through solidarity.
Yeah. Which I believe is the title of their book, right?
Yeah. Safety through solidarity, a handbook fighting anti-Semitism or something.
Yeah. And I assume then you've been speaking so personally about the actions that you took. Were you engaged in this kind of love through Twitter? I mean, as silly as that sounds.
Yeah, I don't know. In some ways, I think maybe love, revolutionary love in a way. Yeah, trying to change myself, learning through studying while organizing and forming relationships with people along the way. I think I see those practices as bound up with each other.
Yeah. And what did that look like in terms of building relationships as part of your praxis post October 7th?
Yeah, I think I've connected with so many new people through on the ground organizing in Durham and also through Twitter, connected with a lot of fellow anti-Zionist Jews and also many other people engaged in Palestinian solidarity work. I think one important friendship I've made through that organizing and tweeting has been with my friend Shoshana Schwabel. I think we connected initially through a tweet that she wrote that was critical of birthright Israel. And I felt like she seemed interested in this kind of emotional, affective, critical analysis that I was making of Zionist rhetorics of hate and love. And so I shared this tweet thread I wrote about Zionist love and hate. And she found that interesting and kind of struck up a conversation through that. But then coincidentally, it turned out that she is the sister of one of the sisters of my ex-girlfriend from 20 years ago. It was this weird coincidence that led us to into a lot of personal kind of kinds of conversations about our different and connected in some ways family histories and our relations with Jewishness. She had gone to a Zionist school growing up. She had broken away from Zionism. We talked a lot about sort of impasses that we were grappling with in trying to understand our relations to Jewishness while wanting to break up with the kinds of normative identities and narratives about Jewishness, especially Zionism. One way we tied this with thinking about Zionism critically was to think of this idea of Jewish self-hatred from a different sort of angle. So we learned from reading this book by Paul Reiter called On the Origins of Jewish Self-Hatred. He does a sort of genealogy of the concept of Jewish self-hatred. And he finds that there's a kind of anarchistic Jewish radical in the early 1900s, Anton Kuh, who wrote about Jewishness from a perspective that both rejected Zionism and also rejected assimilation into German nationalism and tried to blaze an alternative path. I think similarly to how anti-Zionist Jews today are trying to create alternatives to those options. And he has this great line where he critiques Zionism. He says that it says, quote, says yes to what should be rejected and sees as precious what should be destroyed: family, marriage, and a vengeful God. And so he also goes on to critique Jewish or sort of oppressive Jewish traditions, ties with property and marriage and the gender binary and the state. So he's kind of critically, differentially analyzing Judaism's role in creating and maintaining these institutions that have become really infrastructural for capitalism, racial colonial capitalism, and Zionism. Yeah, I think in our discussions of Jewishness from a family abolitionist, kind of queer, communist, anarchist kind of angle, we're talking really intertwining our political and personal stories. I shared with her my story of my sense of kind of multiply feeling outcast at Jewish summer camp, and telling her about how I felt the first kind of sense of queer attraction there. And this was maybe the first time that I'd told anybody this in like 20 years since I'd told her sister that, and other than talking with a therapist. So I had this weird kind of like very personally transformative experience through talking with her about this, because it kind of helped me open up about my own queerness. Since then, I've talked with more people about it, shared with others, including my partner, Jekka. Now I'm talking about it publicly on a podcast.
It's really interesting to me. We've been talking so much about the personal and the political, and I'm wondering if you have a sense of where that comes from, that you're engaged in this solidarity work. You're on the ground, you're on Twitter talking about anti-Zionism, and through a relationship, this what's initially seems to be very separate thing that you've held privately comes forward. Do you have any idea of where that comes about? What made that come out in your conversations with Shoshana?
I think there's this weird way that my sense of vulnerability around this issue of queerness, I think had, or insecurity and vulnerability, I think had prevented me from, or limited my ability to talk about it with other people. And I think, somehow the way that I'd grown up in a heterosexual, heteronormative, straight family culture, I think had really habituated me to keep those queer relations or desires hidden, right? They had a kind of sense of disavowal of those desires, or deflecting from attending to that knowledge continually. And I say queerness and straightness, I mean that in relation to sexuality and gender and family formations, seeing those as bound up with each other. And I think there was something about studying together while also organizing politically, or talking about these personal issues at the same time as talking about the political issues, I think somehow opened up my ability to, or my sense of courage in talking about them. There's some kind of like symbiotic relationship there where, right? Yeah, it was through seeing the parallels between the Zionist way of understanding the world and straight heteronormative way of understanding the world that kind of made me feel more bold to take on those vulnerable personal topics.
So I'd like to turn a little bit, because you've mentioned this world ending, world making, you've mentioned study. And that's how I came to know you, is through your work specifically on abolitionist universities. And for anybody who hears this, I genuinely cannot recommend your book, Beyond Education, highly enough. I just wonder if you could talk about, you know, how all of this, especially your work on the ground at Duke, relates to your research, your writing, everything with abolitionist university studies, with your writing in Beyond Education, and kind of how that connects to everything happening right now.
Yeah. So we're just talking about this kind of abolitionist perspective on family formations, and on Zionism. So seeing abolitionism as simultaneously a kind of world-ending, world-making project. I get that language of world-ending and world-making from Robin Spencer in her book Rehearsals for Living, which is a kind of conversation-based book, her conversation with Leanne Simpson. But that sort of world-ending and world-making approach is one that I'm taking to Zionism and straightness, and thinking of that also in relation to education institutions, including the university. So thinking about how can we dismantle the oppressive features of heteropatriarchal families while creating alternatives, more queer relationships that enact transformative solidarities and love and friendship. At the same time, bringing that sort of question to education institutions from an abolitionist perspective, asking what would it mean to bring this kind of world-ending and world-making movement into the heart of schools and universities? What would an abolitionist approach to education institutions say no to, and what would it say yes to? So I wrote this book, Beyond Education, basically inspired by organizing in that experimental college, which was enacting a kind of alternative way of studying, alternative to the normal universities, because there are no grades and no tuition, and the classes were self-organized by students. I was inspired by that project to think about how we could come up with a better kind of language for talking about what was so different about that project, and to talk about how it could be better supportive of radical movements for making worlds alternative to capitalism, colonialism. So I got into this language of study from Fred Moten and Stefano Harney's work on the Undercommons. They make a distinction between study and education, where they have this kind of critical understanding of education as they call preparation for governance. But I felt like that opposition was a little too stark. And so I came up with this concept of modes of study, where some modes of study could be good, some could be bad, depending on your perspective, or what kind of world-making project you care about, and how those modes of study are bound up with whatever world-making project. So basically I talked about education as a particular mode of study. But I think if I rewrote the book now, I wouldn't say education in general. I don't really say that in the book, but I think it could be interpreted that way. But I'd say more like the dominant form of education, kind of capitalist dominant form of education. Yeah, I think I turned to this language of mode of study to maybe defamiliarize our how we normally come at education, to deromanticize it in a way, and to think more analytically and historically about what practices make up that dominant education, or a dominant mode of study that we tend to call education. I kind of focused on 7 main practices I saw as part of it. This vertical imaginary of students rising up the grades up towards higher education, and a romantic narrative of how they overcome obstacles along the way as kind of heroes in their own romantic life story, rising up the levels. And students in education institutions tend to be separated from their means of studying. Usually their access is mediated by teachers, administrators, rather than having direct control. And seeing education as a kind of preparation for governance, shaping kind of obedient subjects, as a zero point epistemology, which means basically seeing knowledge as created from some zero point floating above the world rather than grounded in particular bodies and places, and a kind of affective economy of credit and debt, which takes the form of grades. And finally, binary figures of educational value and waste, such as the graduate in contrast with the school dropout. And so I in my book, then I give a kind of critical history of how those some of those different elements have emerged historically. And I also contrast that dominant education-based mode of study with alternative modes of study, like especially some indigenous people's modes of studying, like land-based education. For example, in the Deschinta Center for Research and Learning, which is a project that Glenn Coulthard and Leanne Simpson have been involved in. It's a kind of study and research center, land-based education center that grounds learning in indigenous people's ways of life for the purpose of fighting settler colonialism and helping indigenous peoples have resurgences of ways of life.
I don't think I can let you go without asking, as somebody who is deeply engaged in abolitionist university studies and with encampments and these bullshit narratives of anti-Semitism and Jewish safety on campus just flying about, you know, what is your perspective? How would abolitionist university studies folks speak to the encampments and engage with everything that's happened on university campuses in the U.S. and elsewhere in the last 10 months?
So I should say the abolitionist university studies perspective is definitely not my own idea. It's something that's come out of collaboration with many other people. I co-wrote essay, it's an invitation to abolitionist university studies, along with Abby Boggs, Nick Mitchell, and Zach Schwartz-Weinstein. And we've been collaborating with a lot of other folks on developing these ideas in intimate relation with organizing. But I got involved in the academics and staff for Justice in Palestine group at Duke. And along with being more involved with Jewish Voice for Peace in Durham. And through that organizing, I was connected with somebody who works at Duke also, who was invited to an anti-Semitism 101 training that the Hillel and the Duke Center for Jewish Life puts on that those are combined at Duke. And so I went to that along with two other staff members who are also involved in Jewish Voice for Peace. And we realized pretty quickly that it was a kind of Zionist indoctrination session. We're giving a very politically slanted view of Jewish history that seemed to legitimate Israel and cropped out the oppression of Palestinian people. And their definition of anti-Semitism is one that basically equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. So we somewhat disrupted that training by calling into question a lot of what they said. And afterwards, we wrote an op-ed about that experience. Since then, I've been involved with some more organizing around trying to confront the influence of Zionist organizations on university campuses. Yeah. At the same time, I also got involved with the Duke Academics and Staff for Justice in Palestine group also supported student protests, including an encampment that UNC Chapel Hill students started, and then others in the area, including Duke students and NC State students joined. And I went there a few times. Since I have two kids, couldn't really camp out myself, but I did bring along my kids to the encampment and found it to be an awesome politicizing experience for them. But it was also a creative experience for them. My five-year-old daughter got to make art. She painted a Palestinian flag. Yeah, so it was a real space of studying and art and organizing and relationship building all bound up together. Yeah, I think since then, I've been talking with some other folks who are involved in abolitionist university studies to think about how we could write some things that can support the Gaza Solidarity Encampments movement and broader Palestine solidarity movements. Yeah, I mean, there's so much to think about there. I think, yeah, one part of that is taking an abolitionist perspective on academic freedom. I think in the protests, sometimes the administrators and Zionist faculty would use the language of academic freedom against the protesters, mm-hmm. weaponizing it, saying that the protests, the encampments were impeding academic activities. But I think that an abolitionist perspective on academic freedom can help support uses of that ideal in ways that can be helpful for the Palestine Solidarity Movement, including the encampments. Yeah, particularly thinking about how academic freedom has always been a politically contested concept. And we can see its emergence historically during World War I as having been shaped by the long anti-racist struggles and white supremacist reactions to those struggles. The AUP itself emerged during that time around World War I when there was a Red Scare. That Red Scare had white supremacist parts of it where people engaged in anti-racist activity were red-baited and repressed for both anti-racist activity and labor organizing activity. But I think today, with the Gaza Solidarity Encampments, I think we can see the kind of studying and organizing that people are engaging in those encampments as enacting a kind of alternative abolitionist university within the encampments themselves, kind of prefiguration of what a radically democratic university could look like. I think I was inspired by hearing University of Chicago professor Iman Abdelhadi talk about these encampments in this way. She said about the Chicago encampment, she said this was a rehearsal. This was us practicing the work of revolution. This is a dispatch from the liberated future that we're all hoping for. I think that kind of vision from the future is part of that, I think, is seeing it as refiguring what a radical alternative abolitionist decolonial university could look like.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I certainly think there's diversity in the encampments, but I saw something very similar that it really was this practice of what you and other abolitionist higher ed folks have been describing as a possibility, this horizontal structure, kind of an emergent structure, but still with knowledge, right? The Penn encampment, which is where I live, Nora Ericott, Omar Bartov, Nala Can Use It Properly, friend of the podcast, Roz Siegel, all came and spoke, and their knowledge was so valued. It was so informative, and there were still deeply cultural practices that were educative, right? My partner and I went to the Passover Seder that JVP did, but it wasn't this kind of hierarchical, distributive, possessed education that you find, right? There's no grade at the end of the encampment. There's no placing people in honors and remedial tracks. It was truly a moment of everybody is in this together, and there was a lot of fucking up, right? I wasn't super involved, but you could just see people. I love the quote that you gave, that it was rehearsal, and it's always practice and navigated, but a gesture towards this possibility of another way of living and learning and studying. So just one more question. I'm wondering what now, right? We're still in the middle of a genocide. You are deeply engaged on the ground and online, and you know, what's next for you?
I think the struggle to support Palestinian liberation seems so much more urgent now for me than it had a year ago, which is embarrassing for me because it should have been urgent for me decades ago. But I'm excited to keep diving into this struggle in solidarity with others, in collaboration with others, support of the Palestinian movement. And at the same time, thinking of how my relation to Jewishness can support that movement, thinking of how I can continue engaging in emancipatory traditions of Jewishness in ways that support the Palestinian movement. Yeah, out of this op-ed that I wrote about, or co-wrote about the Hillel International's Anti-Semitism 101 training, through that writing, I connected with more folks who are interested in organizing an anti-Zionist Jewish group at Duke. Excited to keep building that. That organizing aligns somewhat with the resurgence of the International Jewish Labor Bund, Bundism, which is a movement that started in the same year as political Zionism, 1897, in Eastern Europe, and created by leftist Jewish people who wanted to create safety for themselves, but in a way that wouldn't involve leaving their places for some Zionist utopia or dystopia, but instead to fight where they were, wherever they were in the world. This principle in Yiddish, it's the principle of doikait, which means here-ness. So the idea of seeing wherever they are in the world, in the diaspora around the world, as their home, and fighting, organizing, struggling in solidarity with other peoples in those places to fight for justice and equality, socialism, without relying on a state. So I'm excited to keep organizing along those lines with other folks, while also continuing to organize with academics and staff for Justice in Palestine group, and also working with other folks to study and organize against the influence of Zionist organizations like Hillel International and the ADL on universities and other institutions.
Thanks so much for listening. Today's episode was produced by Yarden Amran. Additional production work from Sam Haley. You can find us on Instagram at AnotherEdIsPossible. A few notes from today's episode. When Eli mentions his Jewishness in relation to emancipatory traditions, he's drawing on a recent essay by his friend and future Another Education Is Possible guest, Joe Grimm Feinberg. It's an essay in Mondavice. Similarly, his discussions of queerness and coming out are inspired by a recent essay by his friend Alexis Shotwell that's called Challenging Straightness. Eli has been donating to the Gaza Mutual Aid Collective. We encourage our listeners to do the same. You can find them on Instagram at Gaza Mutual Aid. We'll be back soon with another Education Is Possible. Thanks for listening.